Endless Hustle, presented by Murph's Condiments. Murph's Condiments is a spicy food company based in Denver, Colorado, that makes healthy hot and wing sauces using all natural and fresh ingredients. If you live outside the state of Colorado, you can buy their hot sauces online at www.murphscondiments.com.
I fought a good fight. I finished my football race. And after 18 years, it's time.
Basketball players, we're really supposed to shut up and dribble, but I'm glad we do a little bit more than that.
Eventually, every ball would go flat, but that doesn't mean that your life will flatline. What will you do when the game is over?
Hello, Endless Hustlers, episode 106 of Bro Bible's Endless Hustle. I am, as always, your host, Arthur Cade. We have a banger of a triple header ahead. We've got music, we've got sports, and we've got chefs. What a winning episode. We're kicking the episode off with a band that I grew up loving, and in full disclosure, sent me a brand new guitar signed by the band. We have Ed Roland, the lead singer of Collective Soul. I can't even describe it. They sent me a guitar signed by the band. I've never had that happen. I've been doing this for, God, over a decade. Nobody sent me a guitar. So I want to start by saying an enormous thank you to Ed Roland and the incredible, incredible guys of the Collective Soul. They have new music. They're on tour. They're just awesome. They were one of my favorite 90s bands. So just an absolute pleasure to have Ed on the show. Next up, we have one of the biggest chefs in the world, the guy behind Mama Fuco, which as a New Yorker, you know, Mama Fuco is what I'm all about. David Chang has become one of the most popular culinary TV personalities out there. He has a brand new show out called The Next Thing You Eat on Hulu. And we had an unbelievable conversation about his career, the show, and where the culinary scene is moving to. You guys are going to love that. And then we're finishing up the episode with Chicago Cubs superstar Ian Happ. You're going to love this conversation because Ian is one of the investors of John Boy Media. If you haven't heard of John Boy Media, they are quickly becoming one of the biggest podcasts and entertainment networks out there. And we just talk all about getting involved with John Boy, his podcast, a lot of great stuff. Also, he's had a great athletic career, and he really walked me through a lot of the financial decisions that he made. Really great conversation about just what it's like to be a young superstar, both in high school, college, come from just a blue-collar city and make it into professional athletics. But I loved the chat about John Boy Media. I'm a big fan of John Boy, so it was great to get to know Ian and what they're doing over there. So let's kick this off. We're starting the episode with Ed Roland from Collective Soul. All right, we got a great day on the Endless Hustle as I'm joined by, you know, a guy that I grew up with, I feel like, is someone who was part of my life, especially during the formative years of the 90s, part of the great grunge era, the great alt rock era, and is still doing it all these years later. Ed Roland from Collective Soul. I'll never forget Shine, man. MTV was hot at that time. Music videos were happening, and Shine was one of the biggest. It's a pretty cool moment, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, once again, it was funny because the song became bigger than the band because it just happened so quickly, you know, and it's so funny nowadays we tour and, you know, you'll go, what band are you? I'll go, Collective Soul. I don't know those songs. And I go, yeah, oh, I love that song. So we've been catching up for the last 27 years over Shine.
Hey, it's not a bad way to do it, though. Listen, it's going to happen one way or the other. Let it happen, right?
That's correct. Sean begot all the other songs too, so it's good. You got to have one to start somewhere.
By the way, you have like 8 other number ones. That's the other. I mean, there were some other huge songs, but Shine, bands will have that moment where that one song becomes iconic, and it's got to be a cool feeling. So when that happens, because I want to talk about your whole career and I want to talk about your new EP, but when that moment happens, what the fuck's going through your head when Shine? Because I know you had pre-recorded, come out, then the album is re-released. What's going through your head as this thing explodes?
You know, it took us about 7 years to even realize what went on during that whole 7 years to kind of ground ourselves because we were, you know, it happened overnight and it was a batch of demos I made in a basement by myself. The original Shine is a drum machine, me on a drum machine. And there was no band. And I just was trying to get a publishing deal. So the first CD, the Hints Allegations, was just me trying to demo songs to get a publishing deal. And then all of a sudden, I would just send it out to everybody, publishers, radio stations, and all of a sudden, Shine started getting played. And I didn't even have a band. So my brother was kind of playing in this frat band. So I'll never forget, I called him up and I said, hey, can you learn like 3 or 4 songs? We got asked to play, it was album 88 at the time, their Christmas party. And it was their number one song. And we just didn't know what was going on. It just happened so fast. And then, you know, 4 months later, we're at Woodstock. Then we're on tour with Aerosmith. And, you know, we were making Every Day Off, because they didn't let us re-record the record because it was a hit. And they were like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, people at Atlantic. So I was really nervous that people were going to perceive us as that, as it really wasn't a band. It was just Ed. And so on our off days, which were few and far in between, we went in the studio because we played so much that, and I was writing all the time, that we kind of developed ourselves on the tour. That first tour, and days off, we went in and made the second record, and we got it out, I think, in like 9 or 10 months after the first one came out, just because we were nervous that people thought we'd, you know, one hit wonder, and we had yet to even prove ourselves as a band.
So you essentially have this hit song, you have no band, you pretty much faked it till you made it, and then it's like shit explodes, and you're like, let's go make another, we got to make another album, let's capitalize.
Right. Well, not only that, but we just really felt like during the whole run that we were developing our own sound. It was helping me write, had good players. And the other thing, it was smart of us to do the second one real quick. But at the same time, that one became the biggest success we had. So once again, we were just slammed again. And then on the third one, we were in a lawsuit with our manager. I mean, it just never ended. And we were living off $150 a week. You know, number one on MTV. I had my dad, who was a minister, one of his people in his church had a little cabin on a cow farm. So he allowed me to live there. I'd literally get up, cut wood, put it on the stove. That was our stove and heating. Like, it was just an old school Southern cabin. So we made the third record in a cow farm, basically. It just never ended. And then the fourth one, we kind of spoiled ourselves and took our time. It took about 5 years before we took a breath, to be honest with you.
You have this mega song and you're living off $150 a week.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Everybody moved back in with their parents except me. I was newly married, so that kind of felt weird. But if this guy wouldn't have given me the cow farm for free, it'd have been more comfortable being at mom and dad's house at the time. But it also gave us freedom. We'd come over and we could record the record. And we really weren't supposed to be recording. So we called it, we were just demoing. But when it was done at the end, we felt we wanted people to hear it. Because it does sound like a demo, but it was what we were going through. And it was a, you know, 10 by 12 room. We just sat in there, played it till we felt it sounded right.
You come off, obviously, that first album. Is the weight on your shoulders at that point? Do you feel like, shit, now we made it, we've got to deliver more hits? Or are you in a relaxed mood? What's kind of the mindset coming out of that?
I was excited. That's all I ever wanted to do, was write songs. You know, there's that old saying, you know, have forever to write your first record and then, you know, no time to write the second one. Well, I looked at it, had my whole life to write the first record, and now I can pay rent. If I'd have gotten paid, you know, I can buy a car. So I felt no pressure at all. The only pressure came during the lawsuit. You know, that was a difficult time. But that was no pressure on career or writing or creating. We've never had that problem. I mean, like I said, I think it's gotten easier. The songwriting to me has gotten better. You know, you'd like to go back in time and have what you're doing now presented then, because, you know, after 27 years, you should be getting better at it. And the band's gotten really, you know, the lineup we have now is just amazing. We have so much fun. You know, back then, like you said earlier, we didn't know if we were having fun, if we were miserable, we were just going, you know, we didn't know what town this was for, cell phones. We didn't have a tour schedule. We were just, no one knew. It was just putting it together as fast as they could, because it happened so quickly overnight, kind of.
That was my childhood. I mean, I remember you had the Seattle explosion, obviously Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and you got that whole group. Then you got the Atlanta group. It's got you guys and REM and there's this alt-rock explosion and essentially a new genre of music that's a takeoff of what classic rock used to be. What was it actually like back then? What were the relationships with the bands? What was the culture? What put me in your shoes back then?
Well, I'll never forget that when we drove up to do Woodstock 94, Live had just come on the scene too. They were having the same success and they were younger, you know, they were 19-year-old kids, you know. But we all got out and exchanged pics, you know. We still have each other's numbers. We call, check on each other, even after 27 years. And then I'll never forget, King's X was there. And we were fans at that point, if that makes sense. We couldn't even believe where we were. So we followed King's X around the whole backstage area to finally Doug turned around and said, what do y'all want? And we're like, we're just fans. We just want to say, hey, you know, and you create relationships that are still there. I think we played with Blues Travelers that day, Sheryl Crow. So we all stay in touch. And it's always been that kind of, I can't think of any bands in that generation where there was anything other than just total respect. And, you know, once we felt comfortable with ourselves, you know, and not run around like little teenage boys saying hey to all these boys, the bands, everything calmed down. It was, I mean, I look back on it, that part of it, I can remember. It's just really everybody was so happy to be in the place they were.
When you kind of look around at that moment, obviously there's no social media, there's no pressure to be on Twitter and Instagram. There was a certain innocence to it at that point.
Right.
Are you guys able to have fun? I feel like today nobody can have fun because everybody's got their phone out. What was the actual fun like back then?
It was just basically the same as we do today. You know, just hang out. That's the whole brotherhood of thing because you have to be together. You're basically on a small submarine going down a highway, you know, 200, 250 days a year. You have to get along with each other. And that was the cool thing about other bands. They could relate to that also, and we could too. So when we got together, basically it's just silliness, you know, go to a bar and shoot the shit, and you know, everybody have their good stories, you know. I'll never forget, we were playing, where was it? What's the thing in Milwaukee? Summerfest. And Foo Fighters was playing on one side, and we were on the other stage, and we were live on the radio. So they got done with their set because we wanted to say hey to Dave, and he wanted to say hey. And we could see them driving from the stage, driving away. So I was live on the radio, and I said, hey, Dave, sorry we couldn't see you. Seth's running over 10 minutes. They backed the cars up, came up to the stage, sat side stage, and just sat there and watched the last 10 minutes of our show. And then we just hung out and talked, you know, just what boys do. There was no craziness, you know. We were pretty stable for the most part.
You literally communicated with the Foo Fighters over the radio, and then they came back. That's amazing.
I know, but that kind of shows you like the brotherhood of all those bands back then. It was just that way.
I want to talk to you about Dave because I'm an enormous Foo Fighters fan. I grew up loving Nirvana. They were just such groundbreaking music. And obviously when Kurt ended up killing himself, it was just a horrendous moment for everybody. When you kind of look at someone like Dave and obviously what he's been able to become at this point, he's this generation's Paul McCartney for the most part. He's right. A, you know, he's a guy who's mastered every instrument, one of the best songwriters of all time. Young Dave, did you have any idea that Dave Grohl would become Dave Grohl? And could you see the formation at that time?
We could as a band. Because, you know, I think this was after their second album came out. And, you know, that was, we put it on and listen. And then when you meet him, you see the persona and the personality. He's the real deal. I mean, he's a real down-to-earth guy. Like, you want to be his friend, you know? He's just that, he has that aura and personality. And then the music, you know, has the talk and says everything for you there.
Did you imagine you would have this longevity? Obviously, here you are, new EP. You guys are still touring. Did you imagine that this thing would be going this long? You'd still be together and be able to do this?
Yeah, we really did. Now, there was a part where we had to exchange a couple of players. But now that we've got it together, I mean, yeah, I don't see it ever ending. I really don't. And, you know, we have two albums in the can right now. We're just waiting for the pandemic thing to end so we can kind of put it out at the right time to help with the tour and the tour help with the record. So we have two in the can. I've written two other albums. So at least good 4 or 5 more years, you got to put up with Collectus Hall.
So I don't know if you've been hit up about this, but obviously Norm Macdonald just passed away, one of the great comedians.
Right.
And there's a very famous clip of him on a talk show just being Norm Macdonald. And the clip has gone viral again. Guess who the musical guest was that night?
It was McCormick. Yeah, we put it up. We remember meeting him. He's just as, he didn't change once he met you. It was just funny, joke, sarcastic, but witty sarcasm. He was awesome. That was the only time we got to meet him or see him. But I mean, that was, you know, one of those memorable nights too. We've had a lot of those. We've been very fortunate on things like that. You know, every time we've done those talk shows, you either get somebody you kind of respect or you don't. We've always just, you know, from Chris Farley, David Spade, Betty White. I don't know. We've just been lucky with all the, and every one of them come in the room and hang out, just talk. They come in our room, you know. I guess we're inviting. We're Southern boys, open door policy.
How weird was that when it happened? Were people hitting you up out of the blue? Were people like, hey, you're on this clip, like you're in this insane moment?
I've had a couple, and then that's, we just put, I think we sent it to our man. We put it up on our website, didn't we? Yeah. But it, you know, you forget about those things. And then when I saw it, I was like, oh, I remember. And then at the end, when they say Collect a Soul, I was like, of course I should remember it, you know.
Having done all these incredible experiences, obviously you mentioned Woodstock, SNL. I mean, there's so much great shit that you've gotten to do. What have been some of the most memorable and some of the craziest stories that you just never imagined would take place in your life?
The most memorable one for me is, of course, meeting your idols. Like Elton John's my idol. I mean, I'm not afraid to say that. And I was saying that in 94 when we first came out. You know, the grunge thing was huge. And, you know, everybody was talking about, you know, these underground bands that were influential to them. And they'd ask me, and I only had FM radio. So mine was Elton John, man. I was just like, and the weird thing, Elton called me while we were at Woodstock 94. He had some photographer come over, and, you know, he lives in Atlanta. So we became friends. He gave me a grand piano. I mean, gave me a grand piano. Like, it's crazy. You know, touring with Van Halen was awesome. Eddie gave me his guitar after the tour. Dolly Parton singing a song, winning a Grammy. I can just go on and on. Just sustaining for 27 years is awesome.
And hopefully it's more than $150 a week right now.
Yeah, we're doing pretty good. Right, management?
I want to talk to you about Eddie Van Halen, because obviously one of the greatest guitarists, if not the greatest to have ever lived, but also a very polarizing figure off the stage. And you would hear different things from different people. What was Eddie actually like as a person?
So when we came on the tour, Eddie was sober, and I'll never forget where we were in the arena. It was rehearsal day. And I'm standing there, and all of a sudden I hear this guitar, and I smell the cigarette smoke. And he looks at me, he goes, I'm Eddie Van Halen. I said, hey, I'm Ed. He goes, and this is how honest he was at the time. He goes, I just want to tell you something. This is the first time I've played sober. I'm really, really nervous. And I said, well, this is the first time I've ever had to open for Van Halen. I'm really, really nervous myself, buddy. And we kind of hit it off there. First time I played golf, Eddie would come on our bus all the time. He announced King Pal. He took me to play golf for the first time and made great advice. He was like, get out, bike, you know, learn to play golf. Because he goes, every hotel room is the same. They got a shitter, a bed, a phone, and TV. He says, you'll usually end up at the bar and you'll stay there too long. And he said, get out and play golf. And that became literally what, you know, really, I took that advice to heart, you know. Doesn't mean I don't drink, but I don't stay at the bar all night now. I'm like, I got a golf game in the morning. I got to go, boys.
I'm a huge golf lover. Let's talk some golf. So talk to me about your love of golf. How did you become a fan? Are you a fan? And what does it look like now?
I was a fan of golf, but, you know, we didn't have the money or resources or even a golf course nearest where I grew up. But I can still remember, we were just big fans at the time. My dad was a big fan of Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus. So every Sunday at the Masters, my dad would wear a green jacket while he preached. I was like, that's so, and you know, you get so busy in life, you know, I didn't have any money to learn to play golf. And then when I started with Eddie, it just really clicked in, you know, and getting to do things with Tiger and hang out with him, who to me, my generation probably still could be, you know, you hate to say anything negative. It's not negative or compare, you know, athletes, but for my generation, he's definitely by far the, there's Tiger and then there's everybody else to me. And now in today's world, I kind of like the Kupka, the DeChambeau little feud going on. That's kind of interesting. But there's so many young talent out there now. It's filled with so much. There's, you know, it may be that way for a while. I don't know how you can get the difference that Tiger had with the field there for like 7 years. I don't know how you can, one person can do that now because there's so many great young players.
So what is an Ed Rollins golf bag?
What do you mean? Like the usual? Well, I've gotten a little older now. Now I've got a hybrid five iron and four iron. So I'm not out there to prove anything other than, you know, try to win some bucks off somebody. So I get the tee box of my choosing and my clubs that I like to swing. So
are you a big fanatic with what you actually use? Are you incredibly particular?
I am now. I just got fitted for the first time 2 years ago, and that made a huge difference. I don't know why I never did that. I just didn't see the idea. I mean, the science behind it, but it made a big difference. And that's why I said I got a five hybrid, four hybrid iron. It just made a big difference for my game. And once again, I'm a bogey golfer. I took it real serious for a second where, you know, I got my handicap single digit, and then it's like everything else. I was like, wait a second, I'm getting too serious about this. You know, I'd get up and run 6 miles, go play 18 holes of golf and do a show that night. And I was like, man, my body's giving out a little bit. Plus, you know, I need to prioritize here. I've got to do the show. So the 6 miles are out the door. So I'm just going to play golf and enjoy it. So I'm a bogey golfer. You know, I can just play and have fun. It's what I do.
You're obviously Tiger's generation because Tiger and I are pretty much the same age. So when he gets to meet you, he's probably a fan of Collective Soul, and I'm guessing music of that era. What was his reaction when he got to meet you, and what was he like to hang out with?
You know, he's really a nice guy. He's just, at that time, you know, you could tell there were things going on. You know, we didn't talk about anything like that. And he asked me to, I went out and played his tournament, you know, musical guest. And he's an athlete that most athletes that I meet are of that greatness. Their focus is so hardcore on what they do, like the sport that they do. Baseball players that I met that are, you know, Hall of Fame, they, if you get them off the field and give them 5 minutes to let them not know that they don't have to kill you or win, you know, we're just going to hang, you find that. But they're just so focused, you know. And I guess we all are. I mean, I get on stage, I don't have to be that focused, but he was intense. I will say that. But then you relax a little bit and it's just jokes flying all over the place. It's fun.
You have all these beautiful guitars behind you with a gajillion signatures. What are those?
I have no idea. This is my manager's office. I couldn't read this scribbling. I don't know why people sign their names where you can't see what their names are. By the way, I learned when I sign my name, you can understand it says Ed Rowland. And that comes from Arnold Palmer. I don't know if you read his book. When he signed his name, his autograph, he said, you want people to know your name. So I always took that to heart. Another golf lesson. How many guitars y'all got in here? A lot.
Yeah, it's like a lot. Like 100.
I own about 300 guitars now. So, you know, it's just, my wife's like, how many do you need? And I'm like, I don't know. I really don't know. Money well spent. You wouldn't want me to spend it on other places that some men do.
And I'm starting to think that's why they put you on a $150 a week budget before, because you were spending money in the wrong places.
Well, not really, because it's a tax write-off and I do use them all. I mean, I get them and I'm about to go pick up five today. What I've learned to do is have it shipped to my neighbor's house because I have so many in the house. She's not going to go down there and count every one of them. So I sneakily, is that a good word? Is that a Southern hillbilly word? Sneakily. I just bring them in quiet in the night.
Well, what happens when you start to make real money? Obviously, you're going through the early stages. You've got massive hits, but you're going through the battle with the manager and all that shit. But when you start actually seeing the real money, how do you start splurging? What are some of the fun things that you started doing?
You know what? When we have time off, I enjoy vacations with my family. We're very family oriented. You know, we're very blessed that we like each other as a band, but also our families like each other, the wives, the kids. So we'll do vacations together as a band. And then that's it. Guitars, that I do like shoes. I got a lot of shoes, but my feet haven't grown in 30 years. That's my excuse to my wife there. She's like, how many shoes do you need? I'm like, I don't know, but my feet haven't grown in 35, 40 years, I guess. They're going to accumulate. There's nothing. Yeah, I mean, we have a very modest home, and it's something that we enjoy life to what we enjoy. And then I want to make sure there's comfort for my children, that they can, at some point, whatever career they want to choose, they have something to kind of bounce off of, you know, monetarily.
At what point do your kids realize their dad's a famous rocker? Is that something they had to deal with in school? Is it something that they never cared about? Was it like, were they literally using your name at the doors at clubs? What was the dynamic like?
No, I was just dad. And the only time, like, my youngest, his friends came over one day, and one of them goes, oh, you're the rock star. And I said, no, I'm Lennon's father, you know, and they get, and that's all it takes. You know, that's the only time. Like, it's just never been, I'm just dad. They don't come to shows. They'll come just to hang out on the bus because they like the bus and they like the lifestyle of the bus. You know, you travel, you got all the food and sodas you want. So other than that, they could care less.
One of my favorite movies is Almost Famous, and I'm sure you've seen it. Mm-hmm. And it's about, obviously, the fictional band Stillwater and the ups and the downs. But there's an amazing moment. It's, you know, become an iconic moment. They're on the bus, and you brought up Elton John, and Tiny Dancer comes on. Right. And you can just see that unified moment where there's this just moment of incredible love and respect and just like, holy shit, we're here together. Right. What was that moment for you and Collective Soul, that Tiny Dancer moment?
We have it every night after a show. Somebody is nominated to DJ, and we sit there after a show. That's our cool downs. We sit there and we sing every night. I mean, it's just, we're just a different breed of band. I mean, my brother's in it, of course, but we truly love each other and enjoy hanging out. Like, we, even if we're off for a week or two, like, we talk every other day. Everybody talks to somebody, or we're group texting jokes and all that fun stuff. We just enjoy each other's company. We really do.
When you kind of look at yourself today as a musician, because you had mentioned you wish you could go back in time and kind of know what you know now, how do you evolve as a musician, as a songwriter, as a singer? What is that evolution like for an artist?
I think for me, I've gotten, I don't want to say worse as a musician. I used to be a really, really good guitarist. But when you surround yourself and with, like, to me, I've got the best, I'm part of the best band, rock band still, and I think it's better. You delegate. You know, there's no reason for me to even attempt to play lead guitar like Jesse, or rhythm like Dean, or of course I can't play drums or bass like Will, but my job is to write the songs, you know, and then we come together and I'll present them. They'll either go yay, nay, or that's interesting. And then Johnny sets his drums up, we horseshoe around, and we play together live as a band as we record. And that's how we learn. And it's so much fun. We'll do five takes and that's it. To me, you just get the vibe then, and that, let it be.
Is it weird to be on stage and see these kids who were once kids who have now grown up with you, who are probably in the crowd now, but they're like middle age, they're our age, they're like 40s, 50s, 60s. Is it strange to kind of look out and see these people that have grown up with you now?
No, I'm just glad they're there, you know? And we've gotten to a generation now where they're bringing their children, which is fun, you know, because, you know, you grow up listening to your parents' music, and if you appreciate it, it's just fun to see the younger generation, you know, our generation hold up their kids. You go over there and you fist pump them and just let them know you appreciate them all being there and sharing it to another generation.
This was awesome. One last question for you. So one of the main reasons that I started the show, Ed, was to talk to successful people about the mentality and the habits that help them form their success. And it's a common mission that we share with our show's presenting sponsor, Unilog, whose mission is to elevate others. What do you incorporate in your life? What habits that allow you to continue to elevate?
I think I go back to my parents, who are the best parents in the world. Like, they taught me patience, and I try to live like they lived. You know, it was family first and no judgment. Do the best you can at what you want to do. Do what you want to do and do the best you can. To me, I meditate, which helps a lot. And the days I skip, my wife knows. She's like, you need to go meditate. So I think it's trying to just bring joy to, I don't care what job you have, bring joy to yourself first. And then that way it'll be shared when you go outside the office or in the office or on the stage or off the stage.
Awesome. This was a blast. Congrats on the new EP. Congrats on the tour. And sounds like we'll be talking more because you got more albums on the way very soon.
I told you, at least another, we'll make it 7 years.
Is there an expiration date, or you're going till the day you drop?
This is funny because I had lunch with Elton's keyboardist, Kim, and my wife was with me, and she asked him, like, are you ever going to retire? He goes, I have. He said, people retire, they travel, they get to meet interesting people, they do what they love to do. He goes, I'm never going to retire. So I remember looking at her going, see, I'm retired.
I love it. Ed, congratulations. Awesome stuff, man. Thanks for a fun interview.
Thank you so much, Arthur.
Take care, man. Good luck. All right, folks, that was, of course, Ed Roland from Collective Soul. Thank you again for the guitar. It's sitting in my living room. Can't thank you enough. One of the coolest gifts I've ever gotten in this career. Next up, one of the biggest chefs, personalities, and just coolest guys on the planet, David Chang. His new show is called The Next Thing You Eat on Hulu. It is awesome. Enjoy it, and you guys are going to love hearing about what it's about. It's so cool. Enjoy David Chang. All right, we got a great day on The Endless Hustle as I'm joined by one of my favorite celebrity chefs, and as a guy, I'm talking about me, of course, right now, not the celebrity chef part, but where I live in the West Village. I'm a Mama Fuko fanatic, so being able to chat with the great David Chang is pretty awesome, man. Great having you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so honored.
So this new show you've got with Hulu is freaking awesome. I got to screen it. And pretty much what I've learned is Elon Musk is now in charge of the culinary institution of food, because the things we're seeing right now, I feel like this is what Elon Musk is imagining for you guys. Who else thinks this stuff up?
I don't know. I've actually never spoken to Elon Musk. So if he's talking about it, maybe that's a good thing, right? To be better prepared for what's around the corner.
You've obviously always been a very forward-thinking chef. And in this show, it's amazing. We get to see all of these cool things happening, from AI to insect farms. I mean, 6 episodes of stuff that I couldn't even imagine in terms of how food is being made, distributed, eaten. How did you jump into this? Like, is this crazy what's happening right now? Are you a fan?
You know, I say that a fan with apprehension, because on one hand, I am super excited. I love future things. I love technology. I love anything that can make my life easier. Simultaneously, I'm also cautious and apprehensive and scared of the implications and repercussions of a lot of these things. So that's what I hope that this series that Morgan and I and the whole team would make is start the conversation and not say, this is good and this is bad. It's like, a lot of it is, I have no idea, guys. I have no idea what this is all going to mean, but let's start talking about it.
You got some of your celebrity friends and acquaintances to join, but the one that I love, and I just recently had him on the show, and he's an absolute riot, is Danny Trejo. Like, that dude is bonkers. He's amazing.
Oh my God. My one regret on the edits is we didn't do a whole 7th episode with that conversation with Danny Trejo, because I mean, he's just the best. I mean, the life that he lived is crazy. You mean, and the humility and experience and wisdom he espouses. I just was like, I felt like I was like, I would have been the first sign up, first to sign up if he started a religious cult. You know, like he's that amazing. And I seriously been telling everybody, Danny Trejo should run for governor of California.
And by the way, has a great taco brand in California. If people don't know, fantastic tacos.
Trejo Tacos, A+.
So how did this idea come about for you? Where do you start thinking? Because you've done Ugly Delicious. I love your stuff on The Ringer. I mean, I love everything on The Ringer. But how does this idea come about?
Well, I was just talking to Morgan Neville, as I normally do, because we're good friends. We worked on projects in the past. And it was born out of us sort of trying to commiserate in the hardships that we all experienced at the beginning of the pandemic, right? God, it's not that long ago, but it was really, it's less bleak now, but it was really hard then. And particularly with the challenges that we're facing in the restaurant industry, and Morgan being the storyteller that he is like, let's start talking about it. Let's start talking to chefs. Let's start talking to your friends. And Morgan I think he had like hundreds of hours of just phone conversations with chefs. And that's how it began. And not a surprise, almost all of those conversations were dreadfully depressing. So we're like, maybe there's a show here about what's on the other side of where we're at. And we wanted to make something that wasn't plastic in its, you know, message and hope, but we wanted to be like, there is hope. There are things that we have to navigate. We do have to be better custodians of our planet. Things that we want people that are watching this to begin to talk about. And that was it. It was born out of the pandemic, and now we're here. Still in the pandemic, but we're here.
I want to turn back the clock because I remember when Mama Fuko got hot. I'm not exactly sure when you started and conceived the first one, but I remember when it first became a name in New York City, and it was like the go-to spot. When you start that, did you ever envision it would become kind of this empire for you and what it's become?
Oh, I didn't think I was going to be alive past the age of 35. So I had no idea. This is, it's all very surreal and strange. But what I'm learning to do at my age of 44 years on this planet is to be grateful and to appreciate all the things that have happened and to just constantly improve and be better.
I'd mentioned that I live in the West Village, and we're in fall in New York, which means you can't get a table anywhere around here right now. So as a man who owns and has owned some of the hottest places in New York City, what is that dynamic like when we're in, obviously pre-COVID, but now we're seeing it again. But when you have one of these hot spots, what is the dynamic as an owner like? I mean, I'm sure celebrities are hitting you up for tables, VIPs. How do you manage when you're the it spot in New York City?
Well, it's not something I like to manage. In fact, when we opened up Co, we decided not to manage it at all and create a reservation system that managed itself without any preferential treatment. It was very transparent. There were 7 days out, and that's how I like to look at it. It's not something I like dealing with or want anyone else to deal with. And it's a blessing and a curse, quite frankly, right? It's an extraordinary feeling to be wanted and to have a product that you create that people want. But there is baggage with that. And it's not always not fun. So again, it's a good and negative simultaneously.
One of the things I'd mentioned that I love about you, like I'm a huge Ringer nut, and I love your podcast, and just seeing how you've been able to branch out outside of the culinary world and essentially build this kind of personal brand for yourself. And, you know, you think back when the Food Network first started, obviously we saw it with the Bobby Flay world and the Emeril Lagasse's and the explosion of the celebrity chef. But as you begin to kind of manage the building of the personal brand versus obviously the culinary brand, how do you kind of manage that? What are the opportunities and being able to really expand on podcasts and TV shows? Is it something you enjoy? How do you kind of expand on all that stuff?
Well, I think first of all, I'm allowed to do that because of the great leadership we have at Momofuku, right? I'm not in the kitchens. I'm not making day-to-day decisions. We have a team on the culinary end. We have Marguerite Mariscal, who I think is just one of the best leaders in the hospitality business, that frees me up to focus on doing more media. And clearly we do the podcast. We have a partnership working on projects with Hulu. And I've always looked at what we do at the restaurants as content. Restaurants, not just us, we make content every night. And it's content that people eat. And it's true. People say you can tell a story. Like, there's no BS in that. And this is content that we're making that I feel is in a similar vein, right? We want it to be educational. We want it to be fun. We want it to be a little bit different and engaging. And I just try to make sure that whatever we're doing on the media end falls and is aligned with all the stuff we do on the food end.
Where did your love for food begin? What are some of your earliest memories where you realized food was your passion?
Well, ironically, I didn't have some moment that was like, I have to become a chef. In fact, my dad did not want me to become a chef, even though he worked in the restaurant industry for many years. But my love of food itself was pretty easy for me to talk about because that's the only real positive, or how should I say, time my family got along was over food. So it's a positive moment in my life growing up. Food has always been a positive for me. And it helps that everyone on my mom's side of the family are just extraordinary cooks. And they express themselves through love, through food, you know, their love through food. And how I got into cooking was I was really bad at everything else. I couldn't get a job. It's quite simple.
When you first break in, you know, I've had so many chefs on the show and I love hearing these stories because realistically, cooking is an art form. It's whether you're an actor or a host or a chef, I feel like all of these things fall under being an artist. And that's what being a chef is. But it's also the hardest career because you have to really work your way up and only a few really break through to what we call the big time. But when you first start, were you like, oh my God, am I going to ever really make it? You know, what was your thought process as a young chef?
I hope we stay in business. I hope I don't get fired. that was really it. It's like, oh my God, is chef going to fire me today? Am I good enough to belong? Do it. You know, it's like, it was just constant self-doubt.
Was there a moment for you where you did realize you were good enough? Like, was it a moment where a dish happened or someone came over like Mick Jagger and was like, listen, kid, this is unbelievable. Was there like this magical moment where you just realized this is pretty awesome?
I would lie if I told you yes, because I tend to focus on the negative and I don't really remember much of the positives, and there are plenty of them. And I suffer from probably severe imposter syndrome. So I just never feel comfortable. In fact, if there's ever a feeling of comfortable or ever a feeling that we made it, I feel that it's all going to fall apart. So I'm working through that. You got to talk to my psychiatrist.
With this show, I absolutely love just seeing you with the celebrities and discover this stuff, because you'd mentioned there's like this feeling of excitement we see on you, feeling of fear sometimes, almost like a feeling of a little kid exploring and discovering something at other moments. When you're going through this, how are you kind of experiencing these things? And talk to maybe one or two or three of the experiences that made you feel a certain level of emotion that surprised you.
I think when I tasted the lab-grown meat for the first time, I was super apprehensive. But then it was like, oh, I get it. Whether people want it or not, it's coming. Same thing when I tasted the salmon. And again, the questions that answer, it doesn't answer, it presents. It's like, we're not going to have wild salmon in the near future. So I would still like to eat salmon. We have already experienced the extinction or depletion of wild Atlantic salmon. So it's like been in our lifetime. So it's quite possible in our lifetimes, you might see Chinook salmon disappear and all of these things. You're just like, oh my goodness. So that was probably the biggest one. The second one was understanding that a lot of technology, robotics, AI is going to, in every facet of our lives, is going to radically alter our how we function. And that's the biggest head scratcher for me, actually, as well. It's like, I want things faster. I like things faster. I'm sure you like things faster, whatever it is. But like, for example, we talk about it, just because I can get all these delicious things delivered, probably, it's probably going to be under 5 minutes, I bet. Whatever I want is going to be there in like 5 minutes. Is that a good thing? Is that a good thing for me? Is that a good thing for you? And so that, those are the questions we try to answer. And I think there are plenty of moments where we're like, wait a second, is this good or bad? You know, is it good that we're going to have, vertical farming everywhere? What does that do for the people that are trying to do it the old fashioned way that are so important to the green markets and things like that? So for every good, there's always like, what do we do here?
So I'm originally from Philadelphia, and arguably the most famous restaurant of all time in Philadelphia is a restaurant called Lebec Finn. And its executive chef was George Perrier, who's a legend, especially in the French culinary community. And George had a very famous quote where he talked about the death of the 4-hour meal, where it used to be this experience where you would sit down at, you know, a 3-star Michelin place, and you would have these exquisite, just course after course meals, but it was also a way to bring us together. And as I listen to you, and obviously we're seeing now the automation of food and the quickening of food happen, what are your thoughts about seeing the death of the longer meal and the ability to really savor and experience a longer meal, but also have the ability to have community, both friends and family, through that type of meal?
I think the death of the 4-hour meal is greatly over-exaggerated. It's always going to be here. And in fact, if you look at some of the busiest restaurants that are destination dining, that's what people want right now. They want that experience. And whether it's 90 minutes or 4 hours, people with everything that's happening in the world today want a reason to celebrate. And I think that is what is more important. How you celebrate, there's going to be more options for that, right? And the long degustation menu is not going to go away. But I think you will see more restaurants serving something that's a little bit more casual. You're probably going to see less new restaurants trying to do the 4-hour tasting menu. Personally, I don't want a 4-hour tasting menu anymore. I want things in under 90 minutes. And I think that is just comes with time. When I was new to food, I was like, give me the longest meal humanly possible. But I didn't have any responsibility other than myself. And now there's no way I could do that, or I could, you know, stay awake for that matter. But, you know, I think it's a really good thing that we have diversity in how we eat, and a 4-hour tasting menu, hey, that's super important as well.
My last question to you, David, one of the reasons that I started the show was to talk to successful people about the mentality and the habits that help make them successful. So my question to you is, what are some of the habits that you incorporate in your daily life that allow you to continue to elevate?
I think number one is to realize every day that I don't have control over anything. You sort of have to surrender to the idea that, like, I can make anything happen. Yes, that's true. But what you can do is work your way towards increasing the percentages for things to go your way. And I think that's a big distinction, because I think selling the idea that you have agency to make something happen, like a self-fulfilling prophecy, is a nice idea and a nice dream. But the reality is, it doesn't explain all the failure and mistakes that need to happen for you to actually become successful. And that's why I think it's important to play it by the percentages rather than like a definitive, this is what is going to happen, because it is not an overnight thing. Nothing is overnight, you know? So, and just be grateful.
Awesome, man. This was a pleasure. Huge fan of yours. Congratulations on the new show. I loved it. And I love Ugly Delicious. I love all your other projects, man. Big fan of yours. So pleasure having you on the show. And thanks for a great chat.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it very much.
All right, folks, that was David Chang. Make sure to check out The Next Thing You Eat on Hulu. Obviously, hearing him describe how cool this show is, I mean, how could you not watch it? It's like AI meets eating, meets the future, meets Elon Musk. Super cool stuff. We're finishing up the episode with Chicago Cubs superstar Ian Happ. Again, John Boy Media is absolutely crushing it. Ian is one of the investors, but also has a podcast on it. If you have a chance, you guys got to check out what John Boy's doing. I love what they're doing over there. And just in general, love this chat with Ian Happ. It is a perfect example of athletes doing entrepreneurial activities, building their brand and having their voice outside of just being an athlete. And Ian really is displaying that in a maximum form. So here he is, Chicago Cubs star Ian Happ. All right, we've got a great day on the Endless Hustle as I'm joined by an athlete who epitomizes Endless Hustle, Ian Happ from the Chicago Cubs. Dude, you've just been killing it both on the field recently, but also off the field. I love everything you're doing with John Boy, coffee. You're all over the place. I want to talk all about it. Let's start with John Boy Media, because you've essentially created your own media network. And how did this all come about? How have you built it? Tell me the whole story.
Yeah, so John Boy was something that was super interesting to me because these were a couple of guys who were attacking baseball media in a different way. Jimmy O'Brien, and he started by just doing these breakdowns on Twitter. He was kind of doing voiceovers of lip reading coaches when they would get thrown out of games or players getting thrown out of games, different situations. And they started to blow up. He had a couple big ones. And then he said, him and his buddy Jake, who grew up together, they said, why don't we start actually doing this podcasting and making a media company? So I kind of, once they started, I liked what they were doing, reached out over the off season, because we had started a podcast during the shutdown when we were quarantined last year during spring training, and said, hey, what would it be like for us to come onto your network to be a part of this? I love what you're doing. And I think that they're giving that perspective of the fan, where the fan wants to hear someone who's similar to them, someone who thinks the same way they do, someone that thinks like a fan, that can say what they want, that isn't under the constructs of an ESPN contract or a Fox contract. They can swear, they can get mad at players, they can be genuine. And so to be able to connect with them and then eventually invest in the company because of my belief that that's where the baseball media landscape is headed. It's headed to a place where players and fans can talk freely about what they're seeing. And then fans can genuinely interact in that way. They can hear raw behind the scenes, unedited thoughts about games and footage. And I think that what they're doing is such a special kind of just niche in what the baseball landscape is.
We're in such a different day and age right now. I mean, there used to, especially amongst professional athletes, there was almost this code of silence when you were actually playing, because major league franchises in all sports are essentially a brand. They're a multi-billion-dollar brand. So you can't have an athlete go rogue and say some stupid shit, and all of a sudden, you know, the franchise is ruined, you know? So we're in this different age where now people like you can essentially start podcasts, but going into it, obviously you still have a professional career where you make millions of dollars to think about. How do you balance the two? How do you say, all right, I want to essentially still be myself and have authenticity, but hey, I also don't want the Cubs disowning me and trading me because I say some stupid shit.
Yeah, I think that's the fine line. Like you have to be genuine. You have to be, when you're doing a podcast or any media, you have to be really genuine with who you are and what you believe. But there's just certain topics that we can't tackle. There are certain things that we have to stay away from. There's certain things that we might say throughout the course of a podcast that have to be edited out. And that was one of our challenges with having players on, is you can have this really honest, raw conversation with teammates, with friends, in a podcast form, because it's just us talking, right? And they let their guard down, to be honest. But then we have to do a great job of editing. And we have to do a great job of you know, taking some of those bits that might be absolutely wonderful content and take it out. But for us, that's not a problem, right? Because we're not here to be media moguls or to be podcast stars. You know, we're here to give the really honest look at teammates and friends and kind of show their best light. And so for us to be able to do that has been a really fun experience.
How do you manage the whole thing? I mean, you guys are on the road for what, like 8 months, and you pretty much have your head down every single day. How are you able to manage the various enterprises that you have on the side?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have a really good team around me. That's kind of the first thing. But one of the things with the podcast going into this year and into spring training, all of last year I was doing the editing. So we would record and I would kind of throw it together on GarageBand, and it was something that for control was good. And especially in the first year of figuring it out and making sure that we weren't saying any stupid shit, making sure that we weren't going out there and making fools of ourselves. But that was going when we were, you know, negotiating with John Boy and talking to him and saying like, hey, I don't know if we can get out an episode a week. I don't know if we can get out 50 episodes a year. Like, there's going to be times we have three guys who are on three different teams and three different time zones, and different schedules, kind of trying to piece together one day a week and 1 hour a week that we can talk to each other and get this out. And so John Boy was able to get us a dedicated editor and someone who would be with us on every episode and edit it for us and throw it together, which was huge. It was a huge game changer. And I was skeptical going in, and still I listened for the first like five episodes, listened to every second, made sure there wasn't a blip and anything. And it's been a huge relief to be able to turn that over. And it's made my time a lot easier on the podcasting. It's been able to get it out for us, but yeah. And through the various other things that we do, my brother and I have worked really closely since I got to the big leagues. He's a Notre Dame MBA. And so we've kind of been hand in hand on everything. And that's been, obviously a huge part of this for me, which is makes it easy to tackle all these different opportunities.
I fucking love that you are editing your own podcast. Like, I'm just literally imagining you coming back from a night game. You're on your laptop in like some random Four Seasons and like some fucking random city, and you're just sitting there editing your podcast. I just love that image.
It was easier to do last year because we couldn't do anything, right? Like, we couldn't go out to dinner. We couldn't go to the bar. We couldn't do anything. So last year, that's how I learned. That's how we got the podcast out at first, without a sponsor, without anything, is I would just, we were in Arizona. We were all stuck together living in the same house. So we'd record, and then I'd spend hours on GarageBand trying to put this thing together, having no clue what I was doing. I got better at it and better at it. And then, during the season last year, we would record an episode or record with a teammate, and then I would kind of piece it together over the course of one or two nights. And it wasn't that tough when you don't have anything else to do. You're looking for a distraction. But then getting into this year, into this spring training and having to do it, waking up at 5 a.m. to spring training and having to find a time to edit a podcast, it was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this for 8 months. It seems like a lot.
So you're a kid from Pittsburgh, and you were very good early on. At what point do you start realizing you might have a chance at the major leagues? Is it in high school? Is it in college? When do you think, all right, this might actually happen for me?
Yeah, it's interesting because being from Western PA, there's definitely some talent there. There's we had guys from my high school, a couple, probably 10 years prior, who had played, who got drafted, gone on to play in the big leagues. But really, it's just when you're a kid, you want to play on the varsity team. And my brother was 6 years older. He played on the varsity team. So I was thinking about, hey, I'm a freshman. I really want to make the varsity team. And then you do that and you're on the varsity team and you're trying to win every day. And then it's like, all right, I'd really want to play Division I baseball. Or I really want to play big, Division I baseball at a ACC, SEC program. So for me, that didn't work out. I had some offers and interests, but I ended up committing to University of Cincinnati and was just thrilled to be able to get a chance to go play Division I college ball. And then I didn't get drafted out of high school. And I had the opportunity to go play my first summer in Cape Cod as a freshman. And that league is the best place in the whole world. It's just a surreal experience to be able to go play with the best college players in the country. And had a really good first summer there, got a lot of interest. And that's kind of when I knew that, being a high draft pick was a really good possibility. and played out my college years. Obviously got drafted by the Cubs. And at that point, you know, that first kind of college summer was when I knew it was a real, real possibility.
So once you kind of know you're going to go in the first round, I'm guessing now the agents are calling, you've got like accountants, financial advisors, everyone's coming out of the woodwork, right? What's the process for someone at that point where you're trying to figure out, you know, you're going to come into millions of dollars, you know, you're going to be drafted high. Like, what's happening at that point?
There's a couple different things. It's changed now some because of the new rules in college, right? But when I was going through it, it's a messed up process because you're trying to make a decision as a 20. I got drafted when I was 20. So you start going through the process. I started going through it when I was 19, you know, and I got drafted when I was 20. And you're trying to make a decision that's going to impact the rest of your life. And you're right, millions of dollars. And you're not legally allowed to have advice. Okay. So you as a 20-year-old who is going to drop out of college is not all that smart. You know, you have no life experience. You don't know what the hell you're doing. And you can't have an agent. You have to call them an advisor. You can only meet with them. You can't meet with them. So you have to do it secretly. That would be like somebody going on trial, but then you can't have a lawyer. It makes absolutely no sense, right? So I'm going through this process, and because if you lose your eligibility, you're screwed. There goes all your leverage, and you have to go and try to play professionally, and you have no leverage. So now you don't make any money. So the whole process is ridiculous, dictated by the NCAA. But I go through the process. You know, my family, luckily around me, was fantastic. My brother was just finishing up at Notre Dame. And so we had, from a financial side, I had him to guide me, which I was unbelievably lucky for early on. You know, my parents were involved, and we ended up, you know, doing the entire agent process of vetting and picking, and took our time really slow. Made that decision, felt great about it. And then you kind of go through the draft process and you're working through your agent, communicating that way. And it's something that as a player, you have no idea what you're doing, and you're going through it and you're trusting different people. And then from the finance side, it's the same thing. It's a learning process the whole way. Luckily my brother and I have been together in lockstep every step of the way. So we've been able to learn from investing experiences, learn from, you know, what we did really early on, learn from what we're doing now. And it's something that I really enjoy. And I think, from a personal aspect, I love investing in companies. I love taking equity stakes in companies that I really believe in, that I use. And I think the NBA's made a great model of it. There's some guys in the NBA that are doing just unbelievable things in investing in what they love, what they do. And I think that more baseball players have that opportunity. I think that it's really easy to take your money and just give it to somebody and run away from it and say, just make sure that I don't run out. But to be really involved, to have that intimate relationship with everything that you're doing from a finance standpoint, to me, that's exciting. And it's something that I love to do. And I think that more baseball players are going to have the opportunity to do that and really be involved in the things that they love.
I mean, you nailed it. Right now, when you look at the NBA guys, everyone from Durant to Steph Curry, those guys are early investors in everything coming out of Silicon Valley right now. And they're actually long-term going to make more money on their investments than they're going to make in their career.
100%. And, you know, CJ McCollum, he just invested in Acres. I think it was in Oregon for a winery, something that he's super passionate about. I know that he's got an interesting shoe deal, I believe, out of Japan. Like, these guys, they're really taking control of their off the court branding. They're taking control of things that they can be involved in. Now, you're talking about guys that are making a significant amount of money on the court every year. So it's easier for them to build out a team. But something that my brother and I are doing together is trying to build out a group that can look at these deals for baseball players. The click size will be smaller, of course, but if you pile together 5 or 10 guys who are going to go in on a deal together that believe in something, you know, I think that's a powerful tool, not only for the player, but then for the company, because then you can say, hey, this is, we have these guys that really believe in what we're doing. And how can we show that to a bunch of different guys and invest that way and make, make what they're doing fun, make this an experience where, hey, you know, you have the opportunity to have an allocation of really safe stuff that's going to, it's going to be with you for the rest of your life. But here are some things that you can use your time in the big leagues, your time here to really grow your portfolio and do some interesting stuff.
What is the agent pitching process like? Because you obviously mentioned the vetting part of it, but what does the pitch actually look like? Is it like college football coaches showing up at your house and they're all parked in the front yard taking turns? How do they pitch you?
It's interesting because there's a lot of different approaches, and you have some of the bigger agencies that are sending kind of foot soldiers out to places like Cape Cod or University of Cincinnati, who, and they even do in the minor leagues when you've signed with an agency and they're coming and they're kind of standing outside the stadium by a bus and they're saying, hey, you, we are interested. Who's your agent? And you know, I was never one that liked that approach. You know, it felt sleazy. It didn't feel very genuine to me. You know, I think the best ones that kind of hit the most for me were always had reached out through someone I trusted, whether it was a coach, whether it was a friend or someone that I had known that could really give that just a little bit of sincerity, I guess, to the beginning of the relationship. And so we narrowed it down pretty quickly to just that kind of the eye test of you know, we looked at a couple larger agencies that had a lot of players. And then we looked at a couple smaller agencies that did the more mom and pop intimate feel. And that was kind of one of both sides of that equation to really sit down and have. So I think we probably took 4 meetings as a family, narrowed it down to 2 final selections, and then kind of did the whole thing. We took 2 meetings with those final 2 and then kind of made the decision from there.
What was your parents' perspective when they see that their kid's going to be making millions of dollars? Like, that's kind of got to be a surreal moment to think, especially like I'm a Philly guy. So Philly and Pittsburgh kind of both have that blue collar mentality. So I think what would my parents, how would they interpret if I was like, by the way, I'm signing a contract for multi-millions. They'd probably be fucking freaked out. How did your parents interpret it all?
Yeah, it's actually so I was born in Westchester in Philly area. So my mom was at UPenn at the time getting her PhD. And then we moved to Pittsburgh. So my parents did a very good job of maybe hiding that they were overwhelmed, or maybe that I didn't see it at the time. It had to be a lot, but they did a good job of taking things one step at a time. And they, in my entire career, they were never overbearing, I guess. They never wanted, it was never about them. It was always, what do you think? How do you think it went? How, you know, how did it make you feel? Because it was, you know, they did a great job of it was my career. And so they would give, you know, they would kind of guide with questions as opposed to, here's what I thought. I didn't love it. It was, what did you think? And then once I would say something, they'd say, well, what about this part of the presentation, or what, you know, how about this one guy in the group? Did he look like a sleazeball to you? Like little things like that to help guide me through it. And like I said, my brother was largely involved as kind of the business finance guy. He was someone who closer to it. He had just played college ball at the University of Duquesne. His head coach at the time, his son had played in the big leagues for 6 or 8 years. So some of those connections where he reached out to people and asked questions and kind of did some background checks on it. So he was super involved and kind of as a family, everybody played their role, but it wasn't like an overbearing, hey, we're so overwhelmed. We don't know what the hell's going on. It was more of a, let's just think through this and do it really purposefully.
My dad would literally be pulling out his phone and being like, what do you think about this Rolex watch for me or this Cartier necklace?
Yeah, there wasn't a lot of that going on at the time, I'm sure, because it was a real focus. And honestly, at the time, we went through the agent process early, but right after that, my dad got diagnosed with brain cancer. So it was something that as soon as that kind of that decision was made, when I went for my second summer on the Cape, my dad was diagnosed with brain cancer. And so we went through that second year of the Cape and going into the draft with kind of a large family health issue looming. And so my brother did a lot of that, and where my mom was taking care of my dad, and we lost him kind of right after I was drafted in October of 15. So it was something great was happening for me personally and for the family. And at the same time, we were losing my dad to brain cancer. So it was a really difficult just balance for the family at that time.
Mental health is such a big conversation right now. And when you touched on that, how are you able to remain focused on the field as you're dealing with life-altering situations off the field?
Yeah, that was the hardest part. I mean, my family and my parents did a really good job at that time of not letting it be heavy on me, of maybe concealing or hiding a lot of things that were happening at the time so that I could focus on being in school and baseball and getting drafted. And so it wasn't kind of until I was drafted and back home, and I was really only home for a minute, that I realized kind of exactly what we were looking at, what was happening, and kind of some of those times you just block out because you can't face the reality and do what you're trying to do at the same time. And one of my dad's big things was that he always wanted me to keep pursuing what I loved. He didn't want me to be worried about what he was going through or get away from that, because that wouldn't have honored him. It wasn't what he wanted in the slightest. So I came home, they sent me back to instructional league for 3 weeks in Arizona, where I finished the season and came home. It was like, hey, I can go to instructional. Like, I don't have to go. Like, I can be here. He was like, no, go. Like, I don't want you being here just to be here. Go and do this. And this is what you need to do. So there was a lot of that. And then after, the hardest part was after I got drafted, having come home from school and be home for a few weeks and get drafted, then I would go to the West Coast. So I'm on the West Coast, 3-hour time difference. They were in Columbus, Ohio at the time. So 3-hour time difference, barely talk to the family. And I'm trying, and the first time I'm away from my college friends who would kind of help get me through some of this stuff. And I at that point, was really struggling from a mental health perspective with anxiety. And so I turned to meditation. It was my brother recommended it to me. He had started using Headspace, the app, and it got me through a lot of that. It helped me day to day. It helped me kind of center myself when I felt like I was spinning. And it was something that not only that year was it big, but the next year when I went for my first full professional season, spring training in Arizona, started the year in Myrtle Beach. And I couldn't call my dad. I couldn't call my dad after games to let him know how it went. I couldn't talk to him about it. I couldn't, things that you'd done for your whole life that you don't realize that you're not going to be able to do anymore. And so that was for me a daily reset, a daily starting point, a way to control my breathing, my mind, to be day to day, to be one step at a time, to be where my feet were. Like, that was a huge starting point for me. And that's when I really dove into mental health. I dove into, for me, what was important, and then to try to help other people and try to spread that message of, look, I'm an athlete. I've been through a lot of shit. It's not easy, and I have all the resources in the world, and it's really hard for me. So if you don't have the resources, or you're not okay talking about it, or you can't reach out and say, look, this is tough, it's going to be even harder. And if I can spread my message of what I've been through, how I've helped myself and kind of that mental fitness that I really believe in, that I believe not only athletes, but everyone can use in their life. If that can help somebody, it's huge.
What was that first day at Wrigley like? Because the two coolest places in the majors are Fenway and Wrigley. So to get to play for either one of those franchises and enter that ballpark knowing you're a player for the first time is got to be just bonkers. The first time you step foot in Wrigley, you're on the field, you're a player. What the hell is going through your head?
It's crazy. Wrigley has this aura to it. It has this presence by itself. Like, without any fans, Wrigley has this 100-plus years of history. It has, you know, Ernie Banks and Greg Maddux and Sammy Sosa and Babe Ruth calling his shot. It has all of this weight where you feel when you step on the field and the stadium's on top of you and the bleach and everything feels like history. And so when you get out there, and I came up in 17 in the middle of, we just won the World Series. We're about to win the division in 17 and go on this run of the best, you know, we're in the middle of the best Cubs baseball ever. And so every game is 40,000 people. It's packed. It's loud. And it was such a special time to be a Cub and to be part of that. And it was just this, man, like, how lucky are we that we get to do this every day? And then you start to go to other stadiums and you see 10, 15, 20,000 people where every single day, didn't matter if it was a Wednesday day game, didn't matter. It's sold out. And you wonder if people in the city even have jobs. You wonder if they even have anything to do, because on a Wednesday in July, there's 40,000 people at Wrigley Field at 1 o'clock.
It's got to be the coolest fucking feeling. I always think to myself, like, I grew up playing basketball. Baseball was never something that I really took to. But there's a feeling at a ballpark that's unlike anything else. It's a feeling of, like, Americana, unlike anything going to an NBA arena or a football stadium. Walking into a true baseball town ballpark, there's nothing like it.
No, and Wrigley now it's this... It's always been a neighborhood, but now everything around the field is built for the field. The Ricketts have done a really good job of that. So you have just people, just swarms and swarms of people, not only in the stadium, but around the stadium to experience everything that's happening around the ballpark. And it's such a special place. And I think that was one of the things we missed last year. We're coming back at the beginning of this year and finally seeing people back in the ballpark, seeing people around the field. Like, it was so, so special.
What was your welcome to the majors moment where you were just like, shit, I can't believe, like, I'm here and I may be out of my league at the moment?
There was two. So I guess my first two kind of happened really quick, where I got to the big leagues, I got called up the day before Mother's Day. So I was with my family. We were all in Salt Lake City because I was playing there in AAA and I have an uncle there. So we were all together in Salt Lake. I got called up while my family's there, which was really cool to be able to tell them in person. And then we fly to St. Louis. My first game wearing the pink Mother's Day jersey, I hit a home run, which is pretty special. And then we all flew. So we were there for 2 days and then we all flew to Wrigley for my Wrigley debut. I flew with the team, obviously, but there was a lot of my family came. They just basically for a week were with me. And I hit a home run in my first game at Wrigley. So those back-to-back were super special. And then maybe 3-4 weeks later, we go to Miami. And I'm playing second base, and Ichiro is playing for the Marlins. And Ichiro grounds out to me, and I throw him out at second or first. And I'm just kind of thinking to myself, Ichiro Suzuki just grounded out to me. I remember getting his rookie card in 2001. 17 years later, I just was at second base and played against him. And it's like, it's the guy you play with. You're playing with your video game characters, like, from your childhood. And you're just thinking to yourself, like, what's going on? Like, I've drafted a team at one point in MVP baseball with Ichiro, John Lester, John Lackey. Like, and now I'm playing with two of those guys and just got a ground ball from the other one. Like, that moment in 2017 was like, this is crazy.
The best thing about Ichiro is, first of all, he still looks like he can play. Anytime you see pictures, he's still got the veins coming down his skinny arms, and you're like, this dude could still whop the shit out of the ball. But then the other crazy thing is, if you take Ichiro's Japan stats and combine them with their major league stats, you could make an argument that he's possibly the greatest hitter of all time.
Of all time. It's insane. And he's still, you know, I can't remember how old he was when he finished up, but he was still looked great. And he was the most flexible guy in the field. He was stretching in right field for the entire game. Just amazing. You watch his BP, and I know he didn't hit a ton of homers in his career, but you watch his batting practice. He had some juice. Like, oh my goodness.
So you had a few weeks ago this whole Skittles incident, which, by the way, I love how Skittles responded. I want to talk to you about that and how that all happened. But, you know, when the NBA was notorious this year because Westbrook had shit thrown on him. People, these fans are like losing their shit now with what they're doing. When something like that happens from a player's mentality, what's going through your head as shit's being lobbed at you?
It's kind of that zoo animal mentality. You know, you have incidents throughout the year where, you know, you're the entertainment on the field. And sometimes you really do feel like a zoo animal where you're like, I know that you wouldn't do that to me on the street. Like you have a net separating you. So you have someone like flipping you the double birds from a foot away. And you're like, I don't think you would do that in the middle of Michigan Ave. But, yeah, something like that, where somebody hits you something, you just, for me, like I'm such a just let's all enjoy the game. I hate negativity from fan base, because like the guys are trying their hardest. They've put their entire life into what they're doing out there. You know, I struggle even like when we're playing against somebody and you see a guy who's having a tough year, like I feel for that dude, because this guy's put his entire life, you know, 30, 25, 30 years into this craft. And I know what it feels like to go through that like months of struggle. Like it's brutal. Like there's no one that hates what's happening more than that person who's on the field. And so, you know, for me, it's just, let's enjoy a baseball game. Let's enjoy, even if your team doesn't win, like enjoy the individual performances, enjoy how impressive it is. Like when I go watch other sports, when I go watch basketball, or, you know, I'm not a huge basketball fan, I'm not a huge football fan, but if I'm going to watch an NBA game, when I see a 6'8" human flying through the air, like that's pretty impressive. Like the pure athletic feats that you're watching are pretty incredible. You know, so when someone hits you with something on the field, it's like, what are we doing? What's the point of that? What are we throwing stuff for? I don't understand. Man,
these fans are just imbeciles when they do that type of stuff. It's like you said it perfectly. You could be in the worst stretch of your career. It doesn't matter. You've worked so fucking hard. We all have bad days, bad months, bad years. To then react that way is absolutely asinine. I'm blown away. When I saw guys dumping stuff on Westbrook in the middle, I was like, what are you guys doing? This is like a human being. But I love how Skittles responded. So how does that all happen? Do they reach out to your team? Like, what was the process?
Yeah, they went through my agency and sent a package. I actually, we haven't been home. So the first time since they sent this stuff, I'll be going to the field today. But I believe it's a helmet made by Skittles, full of Skittles, which is pretty great.
What a genius marketing tactic. Now yeah. The next key is you have to somehow get an endorsement deal with Skittles. That's the next
exactly step. Right. Because there's a strong no free ads policy. So now to actually wear the helmet, I have to get some sort of deal done.
You're officially an influencer now. That's going to be your new title, influencer, Chicago Cubs influencer.
That's exactly right.
I want to talk to you about coffee. How'd you get involved in the coffee business?
Yeah, the coffee. That has been a passion for a long time. Having a brother who's 6 years older definitely didn't hurt. So we lived together kind of right after I got drafted. We moved to Austin, Texas together. And he started to introduce me to, you know, pour over French press, pour over coffee, to some different, you know, brewing methods. And then fell in love with nicer, lighter roast coffees. So when I would go on the road in the big leagues, that was always my thing. I'd go look for a coffee shop and sit down and have a coffee and spend a couple hours. And so during the shutdown, and coffee, you know, investing in a coffee company was always like a pipe dream. And I were shut down in Arizona. There's nothing in the grocery store. I don't have any coffee. We have coffee, but like mostly like we're trying to find an open Starbucks because like there's, we don't have anything in the house. So I was on Twitter and saw this, this tweet that involved a coffee company that was in just south of Chicago. And so I reached out and I said, hey, you know, if you guys have any coffee and would be willing to send some, like I'd love to try it. So I sent 3 bags of coffee with a handwritten note from the founder. And I went out to Target and I bought up the whole pour over kit so I can make it, and made their medium roast from Nicaragua. It was the best coffee I've ever had. Smoothest, best coffee I've ever had. And so I immediately reached out and called my brother. And I go, look, this stuff is legit. I know you haven't had it. You got to trust me. This stuff's unbelievable. When I had the idea of pitching them quarantine coffee. And so I call the founder and I say, hey, I have an idea about doing a new label of your coffee. We'll call it quarantine coffee and we'll give back a portion to COVID relief in Chicago. What do you think? They were already mission based. So they were giving back $1 per pound roasted to wherever they were sourcing the beans from. So they were going to Nicaragua or Guatemala or the Dominican, and they were helping to build houses, schools, whatever in the community. And so they were already mission based. They loved the idea, was completely on board. I think in 2 or 3 weeks, we had the labels done, printed, and we were selling the coffee online. Then we moved into some retail locations here in Chicago. It's been an unbelievable journey. Being a part of that process, learning about the coffee business, it's been really special. We just did a shoot yesterday, actually, about we're coming out with canned cold brew. We're doing a complete revamp on the labels and the marketing side. We've partnered with the First Tee here in Chicago, which is a charity that involves golf that my dad was involved in Pittsburgh, which means a lot to me. The food bank here, Save the Children, both here and globally. So being able for us to have that give back, to have a subscription base that is almost 500 strong, to have all of these different things that we've been able to do, it's been extraordinary to me. I can't believe it. And to now be invested in a coffee company as a pipe dream and have that come true has been incredible.
Are you a golfer?
I'm a huge golfer. Yeah. So my dad worked for the United States Golf Association. He was an agronomist. I had a club in my hand at 18 months, like been literally my entire life. So it's baseball and golf for me. I played in high school. That's my off season is just basically all golf. So that's baseball, golf, and coffee. Those are my things.
So I've got to explore the golfer. I've got to explore the golf for a moment because I always love talking to elite athletes to determine how hard golf really is.
Yeah.
How hard is golf for a professional baseball player?
Extremely, extreme. The ball's not moving, but it's so hard. I don't understand. It's really, I've been doing it my whole life. I can play a little bit, but I've been doing it for my whole life. I got a lot better after I got drafted, but it's a game that brings so many people together. You can play with basically anyone. You can play forever. And I love you can play with anybody. And for the most part, one of the consistent things is everybody has a love-hate relationship with the game. Everybody struggles at a different level. You know, some people struggle and they're shooting 95. Some people struggle and they're shooting 75. It doesn't matter because you're never going to get to that point where you're like, oh no, like I shoot 65 every time and I'm happy. Guys on tour shoot 65 every time. They are miserable half the time because you're always trying to shoot a better score. It's crazy, but it's a beautiful game with a ton of frustration.
So what is an Ian Happ's golf bag? Tell me all the contents inside.
Oh, wow. That's a great question. I don't carry too. I mean, besides the clubs, I always carry a couple extra gloves. For a long time, I carried my dad went to Ohio State. So he would always put a Buckeye, like a lucky Buckeye in the bag. So I've carried a lucky Buckeye in the bag for a long time. I have some hand wipes, Bravo Sierra hand wipes. I'm looking at my bag right now. I'm trying to think what else is in there. Nothing crazy. Nothing crazy. There's no coffee beans in there, but maybe there should be. Maybe I should just like take some with me on the course.
What are your golf clubs of choice?
So I play Mira irons, which is my favorite irons in the world. They're buttery soft. And then, so I've worked with Benton Nardi for a few years. They're out of Chicago, out of Tinley Park. So Benton Nardi does my wedges and my putter for me. We've had a great relationship. They, you know, custom make my wedges, which has been like such a cool thing. I was like a golf nerd who loves golf gear. And then 2-3 iron or Strixon. Those things are like rockets. And then I got the Ping driver. That's the bag.
Dude, you're awesome. This has been an absolute blast chatting with you. One last question before I let you go. So one of the main reasons that I started this show was to talk to successful people from all arenas about the mentality that helped make them successful. And it's a common mission that we share with our show's presenting sponsor, Unilog, whose mission is to elevate others. So for you, Ian, what are the habits you incorporate in your daily life that allow you to continue to elevate?
That's a good question. I think mindfulness meditation, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly meditation, but some form of mindfulness and staying present, I think, is huge. And I think the other one's belief. I think this non-ending belief that you will be successful, that you have what it takes, that you're confident, but the amount of confidence that it takes, that whatever you're doing that day to continue to help yourself be successful, for me, whether it's baseball or business, it's this non-ending belief that I'm taking the right steps to be successful.
Dude, you're awesome. Good luck with the rest of the season. You're like built for broadcasting. There's definitely a career for broadcasting after this is all done, man. You got a great personality.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Great having you on the show, Ian. Good luck with the rest of the year.
Thanks, brother.
See you, bud. All right, folks, that was Chicago Cubs superstar Ian Happ. Again, make sure to check out John Boy Media and all the incredible, incredible work they're doing over there. That's it, folks, for episode 106 of Bro Bible's Endless Hustle. Told you it was going to be a great one. I'd love all these conversations. Make sure to subscribe, rate, show us the love. We've got a bunch more guests coming. I mean, tons and tons of huge stars coming up. Get ready. A bunch of A-listers. I don't want to give away too many names. Some are booked, some have been recorded, but needless to say, you're not going to be disappointed. Either way, follow us on social media. Endless Hustle is on Twitter at @endless_hustle and at Endless Hustle Pod on Instagram. Me personally, I'm at Arthur Cade on Twitter, at It's Me Arthur Cade on Instagram. We're back next week with another round of incredible guests. We love bringing these interviews to you. I love doing this and I want to keep doing it. So we'll see you next Tuesday, Endless Hustlers. Thank you as always for supporting. Another great week of guests in the books. Have a great weekend. Bye, guys.